The New Quantum Era,
a podcast
by Sebastian Hassinger
and Kevin Roney.
Hi there. Hi. Today's interview is with Steve Girvin, professor of physics at Yale. Our carefully laid plans for the topics of conversation for this interview with Professor Girvin were rudely interrupted by the announcement that just that morning of the Nobel Prize, the 2022 Nobel Prize in Physics. That just felt of such powerful relevance around the topic of quantum computing that we had to talk about that. So, that's one of the really interesting topics we covered during this chat.
Yeah, and we wanted to have Steve on because he is a central sort of person in the Yale Quantum Institute, which really has been ground zero for the recent development in superconducting qubits. So the transmon came out of his group, Michel Devoret and Rob Schulkoff's group. A lot of the key figures in industry actually came out of that educational research group. So we had a really interesting talk about some of the history of the superconducting qubit and the transmon in particular, which is a basis for most of the modern superconducting qubits on the market. And then we actually also covered diversity, equality, and inclusion, or DEI, as it's often referred to in academic circles and employment circles. Which I'd seen a number of talks and Steve on a number of panels and interacted with him in a number of ways and always got the sense that he's a really decent person in addition to a brilliant physicist who's played an integral role in the technology. And then I saw him on a panel about DEI and realized that he's not just decent, he really is fundamentally sort of committed to trying to make a difference in this new field in the context of STEM education and the STEM fields, which have not been historically great from a DEI perspective. So I was happy to dig into that topic with him as well.
I so agree, Sebastian. I mean, for such an accomplished guy, we were both of us, I think, really impressed with his genuinely kind and humble approach to all these topics. So hope you enjoy this interview with Professor Steve Girvin.
We're joined today by Professor Steve Girvin from Yale University, who's quite a distinguished personage in the field of quantum computing, and we're looking forward to the conversation. So, Steve, can you start us off with just introducing yourself?
Sure. I'm a professor of physics and applied physics at Yale. I spent a decade being deputy provost for research, but I'm now recovering and... and enjoying really the exciting research progress that's going on in quantum information science. Sort of unusual fact about me is that I grew up in a small village in the Adirondack Mountains in northern New York State. There were 5 kids in my high school class.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's so cool. It's funny how often there is a lot of... solo time in people's childhoods who are in this field. I mean, Claude Shannon sort of famously built a party line or telegraph, I think, on a barbed wire fence. He was that much of a farm kid, right?
Yeah, I mean, I really think that maybe I'm just getting old, but it seems like kids are highly programmed today with no spare moments. And a very productive part of my childhood was having nothing to do but, yeah. but dream and think about stuff. So
yeah. Yeah, we'll have to figure out how to engineer that back into our children's schedules.
Right. I could use it myself now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, and Stephen, we have some ideas on what to discuss for today, but just a little bit more background for the sake of our audience on your primary domains of research would just, I think, help set context.
Yeah. So, you know, many people have come to various forks in the road in their career. And I was my plan in going to graduate school was to be an experimentalist in atomic physics. But I ended up being a theorist working in condensed matter physics, thinking about what electrons do and magnets and superconductors and such. And in 1998, there was a very important superconducting qubit experiment from Yasu Nakamura in Japan. And I had literally never heard of quantum computing or any of this stuff. And I had no idea there were people out there thinking about these things. And when I saw that experiment, which was basically one of the very first superconducting qubit experiments.
That was the measurement of the Rabi oscillation.
Several people had been sort of working on things that we would now call synthetic or artificial atoms, including my colleague, Michel Debray. But this was the first experiment where you could see the analog of what you see when you shine a laser on an atom and it gets excited and de-excited and excited and de-excited. And I was completely taken by this and decided it was, you know, I should change fields. And I moved to Yale in 2001 and began conversations with the wonderful experimental colleagues here, Rob Sholkoff and Michel Debray. And I've been totally disowned by my condensed matter theory colleagues.
I mean, you're still working with superconducting.
Yeah, but I'm a knuckle scraping quantum engineer now.
Down in the lab.
Yeah, and I guess the paper that described the transmon was 2007, I think, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
I find it really fascinating as somebody who's sort of come to the quantum computing industry, 4 years ago now, 5 years ago now, how Yale's kind of like ground zero for superconducting qubits. You've got Jay Gambetta, Chad Rigetti, Alexandre Blais, who's now at Sherbrooke, David Schuster. There's like a who's who of who's building
of QC. Yeah, out of Yale, yeah. No doubt.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty impressive.
Yes, yes. Chad Rigetti was a student here. Andreas Wallroff at Zurich was a postdoc. It's an amazing, amazing crew of alumni here.
Yeah, and Jerry Chow, I think, was
Jerry Chow
as well.
was a student here. Yeah,
yeah. It is quite astounding the wellspring of talent and ideas and creativity. So, that's really amazing, and that's one of the reasons we wanted to have you on was because superconducting qubits are such an important part of the landscape right now in terms of this fascinating sort of struggle to figure out how to make these things, you know, actually productive and learn a bunch of science along the way. Another conversation, I think it might've been the same conversation actually now I think of it with Ken Brown. He described, in the early 2000s, there being sort of several camps around superconducting qubits, flux qubits and all these different sort of almost engineering approaches. There were expressions of a scientific, of that scientific sort of breakthrough of seeing Rabi oscillations. And then the transmon came along and he said, basically it quenched every other conversation. It was now just, that's the way you build them. Was there sort of a self-awareness in the Yale group that you were taking like sort of a radically a different approach that might solve some of the challenges of the other models that existed at the time?
Yes and no. I mean, basically the idea started in the Sholkoff group with Andrew Hauck and Dave Schuster, and then my theory postdoc, Jens Koch. And, you know, we were setting out to solve a very difficult, bad problem that we had, which was charge noise. There are stray, you know, insulators are great, but if you ever trap a charge like a stray electron in there, it can't get out. But unfortunately, it can move around a little bit.
It rattles. It makes a rattle.
Yeah, it rattles, yeah. in some way, which messes up the coherence of any qubit that is sensitive to sort of static electric fields. So there was this sort of vague idea that if we could take the traditional Cooper pair box qubit, which is roughly speaking two tiny pieces of superconductor separated by a tunnel junction, that thing was very sensitive to these stray electric fields. And if we could make it larger and build in more capacitance so that it was cheaper to have more charges sloshing back and forth between the two basically antenna pads or capacitor plates, that would be a good thing. But you know, it wasn't obvious at first. Well, two things weren't obvious. One was that you could do it in a way that wouldn't just make a factor of two improvement, but would make an exponential improvement, which it turned out it did. And that's the part that Jens Koch showed theoretically. But the other part was, okay, now we've built this thing that's not sensitive to electric fields, but we've been using electric fields to measure them. So how do we now measure this thing? And it turned out that even though it's very, very insensitive to low frequency, sort of nearly static electric fields, it's still you can still measure it using what we came to call the dispersive readout, using high frequency microwaves to interrogate the state. So it kind of got a little bit of a free lunch. It got rid of one problem without causing other problems.
And did you expect that breakthrough, or was there a mix of serendipity, or did the theory guide the way? I mean, how did you navigate your way through that?
Well, I came a little bit late to this. I mean, the experimentalists, Rob and Andrew and Dave were starting to think about this and think about the fact that, you know, when you went into this new parameter regime, it would still be sufficiently anharmonic that the frequency of transitions between the ground state and the first state and the second state and third state would all be enough different that you could still treat it as approximately a two-level system. And then it sort of took a while to get our heads around the fact that you could still read this thing out using the dispersive readout that we had developed a couple years earlier. And then, you know, the proof is in the pudding. It worked. And it was also the, you know, very simple structure, very simple fabrication, very easy to work with. It didn't require multi-layers of different metals and so forth.
That, I mean, in retrospect, that feels like a key ingredient in, for example, how quickly IBM has been able to iterate and advance the chip design, is that it is such a simple, physically simple engineering feat to carry out, right? To actually fabricate the things so they can just crank out, you know, iterations and variations and experiments relatively quickly on the hardware side. And it seems
right.
To be
that's important. Of course, you know, if IBM has the resources to do very fancy lithography and fabrications if they need to, but the simpler you keep things, you know, the easier it is to do things. And certainly for an academic institution, it's really important to if you don't have a $1 billion fab line, then you want to keep things as simple as possible. Now, so in the intervening years, you know, the coherence times, the lifetimes of these things have gotten longer and longer. So we're roughly now 1 million times longer than in Nakamura's 1998 experiment. So that's progress. There's a Moore's law there, it's in some sense. But now we're finally probably reaching the point where just being more careful about what we call microwave hygiene, how you don't let microwave signals leak in and out that don't belong there, and other simple tricks have probably come close to the limits, and we're finally now starting to talk to material scientists and people who understand, like, you know, what is sapphire anyway, and what's the surface like, and what happens when you evaporate a metal on it. And, you know, the bulk of sapphire or silicon substrates, they're it's good, but the surface is often not so good. And this was captured by Wolfgang Pauli in the 1930s, who said that God created the bulk, but the devil created the surface. So, you know, the surface, you have to cut the crystal or polish it. And then, you know, wow. Who knows what's happening at the atomic level there. So there's some belief now that there is going to be mileage from trying different materials like tantalum for the superconductor instead of aluminum. There's work at Princeton and here and other places on that, Pittsburgh. And also, you know, maybe learning something about what's going on in the material science that we can use to improve the process.
And Stephen, do you feel like there's room for optimism that maybe these new dimensions of research related to material science could get similarly big improvements in coherence time? I mean, a Moore's law effect would be good. Sometimes those don't last.
Where's the next million coming from?
Yeah, exactly. What have you done for us lately?
Yeah, we're not asking the question, but, you know, I'm sure our viewership is.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. We've seen what might be factors of 2 or 3 improvement from thinking more carefully about the materials. But whether there's going to be another factor of 100 or 1,000 or 1 million is very hard to say. But it would be nice to have, because it would make errors much more rare and therefore much easier to correct.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm tempted by 2 forks in the road in the conversation here. But before I want to get on to error correction. But before we do, you mentioned Pauli, and we've been talking sort of about the roots of superconducting qubits. You know, we happen to be having this conversation on the day when the Nobel Prize in Physics was announced for 2022. And it's really,
broke. Yep.
It seems like a sort of a high watermark in some ways for quantum physics, quantum mechanics, and quantum information science in some ways, because the prize has been given out associated with work to experimentally realize or prove Bell's theorem, right? And I just wonder, I mean, you just described sort of your own evolution from, wanting to get into be an experimentalist and ending up more of a theorist. It's such a fascinating interplay to me that, you know, how quantum theory has sort of ran far ahead of our ability to sort of prove out the details, but it has stood the test over and over and over again as we've developed the capabilities to experimentally probe like the dimensions of the theories. First of all, what's sort of your first thoughts on the news? It seems like it's notable.
Yeah, it's a wonderful recognition of how really fundamental research about, you know, the nature of reality and measurement and so forth can turn out to have important technological implications. So it's certainly a plug for the importance of basic research leading to surprising applications. And, you know, if you, as you hinted at, I mean, this goes back to the great debates between Niels Bohr and Albert Einstein.
Yeah, EPR paradox, the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, Einstein, you know, it's ironic that Einstein really made massive contributions to the development of the quantum theory. And my colleague Doug Stone has an entire book on this subject. And he understood it so well. He understood the weird implications of entanglement that he said, this has to be wrong. It's too crazy.
Reductio ad absurdum, it's too strange.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, in those days, Bohr and Einstein would have fights over Gedanken experiments because you couldn't actually do the experiments. And even Schrodinger thought, well, you'd never be able to do experiments on individual quanta, individual atoms or electrons or photons. And that's really what today's Nobel Prize is about, is the ability to do experiments where you can manipulate individual quanta, in this case, optical photons. And the irony I like to point out is that the way we test whether our quantum computer is a quantum computer is we check first thing in the morning to calibrate it. If it's doing the thing that Einstein said was impossible, then it's working.
That's great. Oh my God.
The impossibility test.
That is a peak moment in this interview, Stephen. Thank you so much.
That's good.
But I'm sure if Einstein were alive today, it would take him about 3 seconds to understand that.
And he'd be pissed.
Well,
or maybe pivot and be delighted and amazed.
No,
yeah.
I think he'd be pretty happy. Yeah.
Me too.
Me too. Do you still to this day, Stephen, feel like some of these? I mean, the epistemological questions that these paradoxes present, they still feel really mind bending to many people on the outside of physics. I mean, are you still feel like, I don't know, you're at peace with what the universe has dealt us?
Well, it was much worse when there were only Gedanken experiments. But it's very hard to argue with careful modern experiments. And, you know, people talk about the measurement problem. But, you know, I've gotten used to the fact that these measurements work. And I've gotten used to the fact that, you know, what you see depends on what you choose to measure, and you can erase it before you look at it. All these crazy things. Once they start happening in the lab, you just kind of get used to them.
Right.
And it was very difficult to get used to it in a sense because it wasn't everyday experience before this, and now it is. But still, it's awfully weird.
It is awfully weird. And I mean, that gets to the root, I think, of the psychological resistance. You know, you mentioned the Gedanken experiment. You know, the cat was meant to illustrate how absurd the intuition was, right? I mean, you can't have a cat state smeared out between alive and dead, right? It just doesn't, there's nothing in our experience that we could anchor that on at that point, as you said, until we had an experimental proof.
Right. And, you know, nowadays we're using Schrodinger cat states as error correcting codes. I mean, we make them all the time. They're, you know, it's amazing. I think that just, you know, as the technology advances, it starts to seem, you know, less and less like magic. But nevertheless, it's extremely weird. And it's still the one topic that I can have. Even experts, you know, like my colleagues, we can have arguments about over how an experiment's going to work. You know, it doesn't last that long. We eventually get it right and correctly predict what's going to happen. But it's like Davy Crockett, I think, said, you know, I've never been lost, but I've been a mite confused for a couple of days. you know, we it's so weird that even we can trip over rocks on the trail. And it's important to emphasize that, you know, this second quantum revolution, it's not because we now realize the original quantum theory was wrong and, you know, we had to modify it or something. it's the same as in 1927.
It's the same axioms as back then, yeah.
Could have all been figured out then, but the implications were so
weird. We just couldn't wrap our heads around, you know, the consequences of the logic.
It took 75 years for people to say, oh, wow, gee, there's something different about information here.
Yeah, and both fundamental breakthroughs like the Josephson junction, as well as, you know, increasingly sophisticated engineering knowledge and techniques to actually be able to fabricate devices that are creating and manipulating artificial atoms. I think that would have blown some minds in the mid-century, right? Like, not that long ago, people were like, you can't do that.
That brings up the topic of how hard it is to predict the future. So, you know, this past Sunday, I gave a public lecture over Zoom at Michigan State, and I showed, you know, that the quantum mechanics led to the tech revolution of the 20th century, the laser, the transistor, the atomic clock, which led to the GPS and so forth. And I showed a picture of the first transistor, and it's like a half inch across, and there's solder blobs hanging
off. It's garbage.
Off.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Wires. Total DIY. Yeah, no doubt.
And do you know how many transistors are produced in the world every second of every day?
It's a very large number.
It's more than trillions, 20 or 30 trillion. Yeah.
I mean, wow. Wow. God.
Every day.
All I can say is it's a good thing they're small. Or, you know, we would run out of stuff. I mean, it's incredible. So looking ahead, it's very, very hard to predict where this is going. But along the way, there's such fantastic basic science and quantum.
Yeah, beautiful ideas, really, really compelling, inspiring concepts. Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah. It's I mean, I'm having more fun now than at any point in my career. It's just wonderful.
That's awesome.
And one of the big themes, Stephen, our podcast around quantum computing is we're constantly trying to sort of see with clarity, you know, this impossible to see thing about what the future will bring for quantum computing. I mean, many people that listen to this podcast, they've been in tech for some time, they sort of see this steep arc of progress. But, you know, there's inside quantum computing, many, you know, skeptics and many optimists. And it's hard to sort of see the balance right. I mean, can you tell us? I mean, it feels like you are on the optimist side of the spectrum. Is that right?
I'm a long-term optimist, but in this public lecture that I just gave, I show the Gartner hype cycle.
Oh, my God. Right.
Yeah. And, you know, artificial intelligence has had multiple winters before finally, you know, they got it able to do some things, very interesting things. I think that will given the level of hype in this field, I'm very worried about that. I always try to say
a quantum winter.
The potential represented by this second quantum revolution, you know, it could possibly be as large as the impact on society as the tech transfer and tech revolution. But the we're so far from there right now with huge problems to overcome because of noise and other difficulties, the great sensitivity of quantum states to the tiniest external perturbations is something that we're going to have to figure out how to deal with. And it, you know, typically one overestimates what you can do in the short term in engineering and underestimates how far things go in the long term. And I'm semi-confident that that's will hold true here, that ultimately if the nation, and I think the federal government is taking a long view on this, if they take a long view and support the basic research through quantum winters and summers for, I don't know how long, but let's say another decade, then I think we'll really have a pretty good idea of whether we can build large scale fault tolerant quantum.
Well, you heard it here. Steve Gervin says 10 years. There you go.
That's right. That's right.
We'll check back in 10 years and see how you do this, Steve.
Okay.
So I think I'm guessing that in some ways your focus on error correction now is because you feel like that's sort of one of the next big hills to climb in terms of, you know, we've got as you said, T1 times of like 100 microseconds in superconducting qubits. That's substantial. It's a huge leap from where we started. So what can we do within the window of those 100 microseconds? And in particular, how can we get more like reliable performance out of an inherently very unreliable system? Is that sort of where your interest is?
Yes. So this is basically amazing theoretical discovery that quantum error correction is possible, which is not obvious because when you look at a quantum system, for example, to see if it has an error, it changes.
Yes.
And you got to figure out some very clever codes such that the change that happens when you look only tells you whether or not there was an error, but not what logical state the error happened in. And it turns out that's possible in principle.
Peter Shor had a hell of a year.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to me, the idea that error correction is possible is much more amazing than the idea that if you had perfect hardware, you could do quantum computing,
you can crack
which itself
RSA.
Is amazing. But,
yeah.
But the error correction is amazing.
It really is.
And the next level up, once it's possible in principle, is this concept of fault tolerance, that my circuit, all my parts make errors, including the parts of the circuit that I build to correct the errors. And yet, if the error rate is low enough, it will still work. And, you know, this goes back to ideas from John von Neumann, who was very interested in how your brain works. I mean, it's just a random collection of, roughly speaking, wires and neurons and talking to each other. And there must be some kind of redundancy or something built in there in order for your brain to function. Not everybody's functioned as well as his, but
no. Particularly good error correction on that brain.
Exactly. So I found it very instructive to go back and read his old papers from the 50s. He also was interested in computers because he was building computers and they would only run for, you know, 20 minutes before they have errors. So it's very instructive to read these old ideas about how you make classical hardware fault tolerant.
Have you read, by the way, Turing's Cathedral by George Dyson?
Yeah, Freeman's son, George. Yeah, that's a great book. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, it really is.
Written by a guy who used to live in a treehouse and got interested in Mac computers to help him design the shapes of canoes. And then he wrote a book about the foundations of computation and mathematics.
Nice transition. Guy. Yeah.
Very nice.
And so, Stephen, one of the major, I think, milestones in this quantum error correction, you know, development, these GKP codes, they feel like fundamental. And so, you know, just help us fill in the narrative and the history where those are situated and their significance to contemporary developments.
Sure. So let's start with just ordinary qubit structures. So you have collections of qubits that you put together to form what we call a logical qubit that stores the information in some spread out way in the entanglement among the physical parts so that it's hard for the outside world to see what the information being stored is, and therefore it can live longer, then you can correct errors. But it's very, no one has really succeeded to make such a code with qubits, because when you have lots of qubits, you have more errors than you started with. So you've taken, every error correcting code starts by taking a giant step backwards and making the errors worse. And then you have to turn on this sort of Maxwell daemon gadget to look for the errors and correct them and take the entropy away. And if you can get it working well enough that you overcome that initial step backwards and get back to where you started with the coherence time of a single physical qubit, we call that reaching break even. And qubits codes haven't really succeeded at that yet. There's some definite good things that have happened in the atomic physics world, but in the superconducting world, maybe people have gotten to half or three quarters of that break-even point. And so the codes that have reached break-even or gone a bit beyond are bosonic codes, codes where the information is stored not in two-level systems like qubits, but in microwave photons or other oscillator states that live in this circuit. So you can have basically an empty box milled out of aluminum. The walls are superconducting and they highly reflect microwave photons, and they can bounce around inside there for a long time. They live longer than qubits. Big ones can even live for a second. And so that's one advantage. The second advantage is you have many, many quantum states. You can have zero photons, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, so forth, just in one box without adding more moving parts. And the errors, you don't have to figure out which qubit had the error. The error is just in this one box. And it's very simple. It's typically you lost a photon. It was absorbed by some dirt in the walls, or it leaked out through the port or something. And so that makes the error correction problem quite a bit easier. And you mentioned this, there are several different bosonic codes, the CAT codes and binomial codes and this GKP code. The GKP code is kind of interesting. It was invented by...
it's a Gottesman, Kataev, Preskill, I think.
Gottesman, Kataev, and Preskill. And these guys are a wonderful, amazing theoretical physicist.
Yeah, that's quite a team.
As I say to John every time John Preskill, every time I see him, you know, John, when you guys describe this code, no person who knew anything about experiment thought it could ever be realized. It's a very strange quantum state. You know, I don't know how to describe it. It's like having a Schrodinger cat that instead of being in two places, it can be in 10 places at once, sort of. But now two different experimental groups have succeeded in making these states. Our friend Jonathan Holm is an ion trap guy in Zurich. There, the oscillator is the mechanical motion of the ions back and forth in the ion trap. And the other is my colleague here at Yale, Michel Devoret, where the coordinate that's oscillating is the electric field inside this aluminum box, this cavity. And Michel has published data that approximately reaches break even, and they have a new generation of the experiment, whose results are being written up right now, where they exceed the break even point by more than a factor of two.
Wow. This is the grid state
states. Yeah. So they have interesting properties under translation. That is, if you move the coordinate back and forth, they're sort of periodic. They look like a picket. Their wave function looks like a picket fence. And it just seemed impossible that you could make such a complicated thing. But in the end, people thought of clever tricks. And it just turns out to be the error correction is working quite well.
That's really interesting. It's so reminiscent, right, of our conversation around the Nobel Prize, right? It's that the original theory just seems so fantastic and impossible to render by experiment, and then a few years later, boom, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, Michelle and I were at a Nobel Symposium on quantum technology in Sweden in August, where today's laureates were also in attendance. And we showed the data to John Preskill, and he immediately started asking for more. Well, you know, when are you going to do two qubit gates? We're still, you know, just at the very beginnings of all this, and have so many things that we have to learn how to do.
I mean, you have our curiosity on this too. When is that paper coming out? Can you tell us of the new results?
Well, I think it's being written now. Also, while the student Vlad Sivak is also writing his thesis, so that he can graduate and go off to Google. But hopefully he's writing quickly on both. But in the next couple of months, I think it'll
great.
Be,
thank
it'll
you.
Be out. And it's amazing. It uses tricks from machine learning, reinforcement learning, to turn all the knobs in the experiment. There's roughly 30 of them.
That is fascinating.
To make it work better.
So it's so cool. Yeah.
Modern artificial intelligence things are coming to help us out here.
But all the way down at the qubit level to somehow
In the controller that's running the experiment. You know, it's got a lot of knobs and you've got to optimize them. And it's a very high dimensional space.
I remember some work a couple years ago around dynamical decoupling, which was injecting sort of pulses in between gates. And
that's right.
There was some work on using machine learning to try to train the noise basically being interjected between gates to try to, you know, reverse the noise, I guess.
This is a little bit like that. It's the basic steps of the algorithm to do the error correction, are all figured out, but they contain parameters and how often should you do the steps. And, you know, also when you turn the knob up at room temperature, exactly what happens to the signal as it goes down to the bottom of the refrigerator is a little uncertain and uncalibrated. And so it's mostly a kind of calibration thing rather than, although it kept adjusting one parameter. We had this theoretical picture of my former postdoc, Baptiste Soyer, who's now a professor at Sherbrooke, had this protocol to do this error correction kind of autonomously, which is one of the reasons the experiment is now doing even better. But he had two parameters in there that theoretically should be the same. And this reinforcement learning agent kept making the second one larger, consistently larger. And it actually taught us something once we looked at it for a while. So why is it doing that? We actually learned some stuff. So it's usually these AI things are black boxes and you don't really know. But this was a very consistent thing that it did. And so we paid attention to it and we learned from it.
That's fascinating.
It's just really great to hear these live reports from right on the edge of this research. So thank you so much. These are fun anecdotes.
Yeah. We're pretty excited about it. And I think the paper will attract... track some notice.
Can't wait. I'll keep an eye on archive.
Yeah.
I wonder, Sebastian, with the remaining time, we had one more issue on the agenda.
Yeah. I mean, I'm curious because I've heard you speak, Steve, on a number of panels around, you know, quantum workforce, the skills development, which is obviously a huge issue. Right now, even in these early stages, we need more people who are entering the field. And it's a nascent field. There isn't really, you know, there's now a PhD at Harvard in quantum computation, but I think everything else is sort of, it's some flavor of physics or some flavor of computer science or computer engineering. And I always think that there's this recognition, as there has been in these panels I've seen you speak on, that we have sort of to some degree, a blank sheet of paper. And we're coming from fields where there's been very poor diversity, equality, and inclusion. The history of physics, the history of computer science is very white male and dominated in nature. And it feels like there are ways in which we can change that at this early stage, it will have a lasting impact on this new field. I'm just curious if you know, to hear your thoughts on that and if you have seen efforts that seem more effective or more promising, because it's, there's a lot of talk about these issues, but it's difficult at times to see practical progress.
Yeah, we still have a long way to go.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, very hard problem. And it is true that we're kind of at the beginning of a completely new thing. And so that's an opportunity to try to make things better, but it's also a time when we really ought to make things better because, you know, if the field explodes and hasn't become equitable from the beginning, it's going to be, you know, very inequitable later.
Too late to make a difference, yeah.
But that doesn't mean that we automatically have good ideas for how to do this. And there's a lot of interest in trying, and it's very, very important to establish a kind of supportive atmosphere in every research group or institution or whatever scale you're talking about, in which people, you know, feel comfortable saying, I don't understand, and asking for help. And I think, you know, we've been lucky here. You know, we still do not have good numbers on gender diversity and so forth here, even though we're trying hard. But I do think we, by and large, have a pretty supportive atmosphere in which people help each other, you know, practice their presentations and feel comfortable sharing ideas with each other because, you know, it'll improve and so forth. And, you know, they're more explicit. That's just a general, you should do that anyway. But, you know, there are more explicit things, you know, we have women in science groups at Yale. We have a small group of women in quantum. It's still not at the level that we would like to see in terms of representation. There's a huge interest in this field among young people, among high school students and undergrads. So I think that can help.
You mean in quantum computation?
Yeah, well, just quantum science generally, but computation in particular. So there's I'm the faculty advisor for the Yale University undergraduate quantum club, and there are lots of people there that are welcome that haven't taken physics. Maybe they've had one computer science course, or maybe they're a humanities person who's heard about this and wants to understand the, you know, what are the ethical implications. So it's pretty welcoming group. And everybody's kind of a beginner thinking about these crazy new ideas. And so it's a good time for everybody, you know, to be supportive of each other as we try to
It does feel like the as you said, there's a growing sort of awareness and excitement about the topics that are making such incredible progress we've been talking about in this conversation. So that's good. It makes the mouth of the funnel wider, right? Which is good. And there's ways we can improve that, improve access and inclusion. I wonder, though, you know, I watched the documentary Picture a Scientist based on your recommendation.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And it's, yeah, like, it's, I mean, I wonder what we can do to, you know, to change the composition of the field when the underlying sort of almost the foundations of the way science is done in the lab have such rigid, you know, a history of rigid hierarchy and power structures and power dynamics that are so easily abused. Not that they, you know, I mean, when there's lots of good actors, but when there's a bad actor, those mechanisms can be abused so horribly. And it feels like such a fundamental challenge.
It is. I mean, that was such a distressing show to watch. And, you know, I'm friends with a couple of those people. And boy, it's just, you know, awful to think about. And, you know, it's very important to have an atmosphere where people are comfortable saying, hey, you know, there's something happening which is not right. And having a formally designated ombudsperson is a mechanism. You know, it'll become easier as we have more more diverse faculty, you know. So you're really talking about kind of the leaky pipeline problem.
Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah.
There's good gender balance at the top of the funnel, but not at the bottom. Mixed metaphors there.
Yeah.
We have to figure out ways to avoid that. And I really think it's easy for people to be blind to the way they come off or appear or the way they deal with some issues and not realize that person is convinced they're not prejudiced, and maybe they aren't, but nevertheless, they're leaving a wake of damage behind them because they're oblivious to the impact of their words or actions. So
yeah, introspection does not come naturally to most people.
So, I mean, another thing that we do, we have several faculty searches going on in this field at the moment. And tomorrow I'll have a 2-hour meeting with our Dean of Science. Everybody that's on any search committee will be in this meeting to have a long discussion about how do you establish your criteria for a position so ahead of time so that you don't adjust the image of the search based on the particular candidate, because that tends to go in one direction. Mm-hmm. The other thing that, you know, you can do in hiring that's very important is I always try to remind people that thinking about diversity when you're doing a hiring search, it's not about adding constraints. You know, you should interview more women or whatever. It's about removing constraints. You should look wider. If you find a person who's, you know, their physics research is not exactly what you were thinking of, but it's interesting and important, and they bring diversity, then you should interview that person. It's really, and when you say it that way, it's a little more convincing to scientists. Oh, I see. Because there's a theorem that if you release constraints, the optimum cannot get worse. It can only get better.
There you go. Right. Precisely. Right. Yes. That a basic math right there. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. So I try to use that kind of language. But boy, it's a hard problem.
Long way to go, but it's great to hear that you've got a team working on opening up these opportunities. It's a foundational time in the change of possible jobs.
Absolutely.
That people can pursue.
Yeah.
So yeah,
and it's going to take all kinds of people. Well, not just diversity of gender, but intellectual interests. I mean,
of class, of race, of creed. Yeah, no doubt. Yeah.
Quantum computers cannot all be hand-built by male PhDs in physics.
Right.
We need electrical engineers and computer scientists and mathematicians.
Yes.
God bless them. And, people that mechanical engineers. I mean, there's all kinds of fascinating problems that everybody has to be humble and say, you know, I, despite being a theoretical physicist, I don't actually know everything. that's the key.
That is the key. I think that is a notable statement coming from a notable
way to go.
Physicist.
that might be a good suitable ending.
It is.
Your admirable humility. Yeah, way to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, back to, you know, the sort of fundamental insight of quantum physics, and you know, the theory seems impossible, and yet we have to sort of humble ourselves before it and recognize that the experimental proofs are definitely saying that it is not impossible.
And somehow they found a way through on those hard problems. We can find a way through on the DEI problems, right?
Yeah. Well, great. Any last comments? Anything you wanted to cover that we haven't?
Well, it's been a great conversation.
I would again
iterate that there's a good reason for all this excitement, but let's be very careful as a community about severely overhyping this, because it's going to take a while before we reach the promised land.
Yeah, there it is.
Thank you so much.
Steve, we're so grateful for your time. Thank you.
Pleasure. It was great chatting with you. Thank you.
Wow, that was fun. It just felt so satisfying for me to dig into the really interesting backstory behind this year's Nobel Prize in Physics. And the overall story of, you know, EPR, pairs, entanglement, spooky action at a distance, Bell's theorem. Yeah, that's just always fun mind food. Love talking about that
absolutely.
Stuff.
It's so interesting that you know, the theory behind that caused so much controversy that it took a long time for us to get around to actual experimental proof of those theorem, the Bell's theorem. And that's really the basis of the Nobel Prize this year.
Really quite amazing. And, you know, the interesting thing that he related during the interview, I didn't fully realize this until recently, is that, you know, again, these Nobel Prizes around experiments related to how to show a violation, right, of Bell's inequality, which was predicted by the axioms of quantum mechanics. But that very same test is essentially the boot-up test you do to sort of know for sure you've got at least the baseline level of a quantum computer fully functional. So I just thought that was a great connection, right, between, you know, QC and today's, or rather yesterday's Nobel Prize. Pretty cool.
Exactly. It's a field, as Steve said, that's based on waking up in the morning and doing something impossible right off the bat to make sure the machine's still working.
He seems so confident and almost accepting of the strangeness of all this, you know, the consequences of quantum
old hat.
I'm still not there, man, but no. More power to him. Oh, and also, I got to tell you, I mean, that way, I was on the edge of my seat while he's talking about these new results in quantum error correction. I mean, it sounds like soon to hit archive will be some breakthrough results that are actually kind of a big deal. And what was especially fascinating for me, right, is this cool connection between, these multiple physical qubits representing one logical qubit, all controlled by, and error corrected by machine learning algorithms. I mean,
right.
That's some
unclassical,
some
hardware.
Rich, tasty algorithm work right there, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. And it does seem to be tracking with an overall trend of deeper integration of classical compute resources with quantum compute resources to get us closer to that. You know, that the holy grail of the fault tolerant universal quantum computer that we're all striving towards.
All the way, closer and closer.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it was great fun. All right. Well, I hope everybody enjoyed that. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you on the next episode.
Okay, that's it for this episode of The New Quantum Era, a podcast by Sebastian Hassinger and Kevin Roney. Our cool theme music was composed and played by Omar Costa Hamido. Production work is done by our wonderful team over at PodFi. If you are at all like us and enjoy this rich, deep, and interesting topic, please subscribe to our podcast on whichever platform you may stream from. And even consider, if you like what you've heard today, reviewing us on iTunes and/or mentioning us on your preferred social media platforms. We're just trying to get the word out on this fascinating topic and would really appreciate your help spreading the word and building community. Thank you so much for your time.